I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about anxiety. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. We are hardwired for anxiety, which explains why 40 million people have supposedly said they battle it. Anxiety can range from fearing noises in the house at night to symptoms so severe, it's amazing people survive it. The most competent individual can be so stricken that he or she cannot function. The bones feel as if they are rattling with fear. The mind is blank. The panic is massive. Zero sense of control. None. Well, how do we explain what anxiety is, and why is it so extreme in some people? Science, as my guest will tell you, is working on it. He had a genetic test to check on the roots of his own staggering anxieties. What is remarkable about Scott Stossel is that despite his endless anxiety and the torture it instills, he researched and wrote a memoir-style biography of anxiety that took him 8 years. He is very candid about his own symptoms, so many and sometimes so weird that you wouldn't believe a movie that portrayed it this way. But it's real, and Scott Stossel is not alone. So many people have said that sentence, "I think I'm having a nervous breakdown." Whether you have simple anxiety or full-blown episodes, don't miss this conversation because you're about to meet one of the most fearless writers. I think one of the most fearless humans around. Here is a man who used his sometimes twisted mind to understand that twisted mind. Scott Stossel is editor of The Atlantic. He's an author, has contributed to The New Yorker, Wall Street Journal, The New York Times. Scott, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I was thinking about this phrase, nervous breakdown, and I want to tell you something that happened to me once, and I'm doing this for a reason, not because I think I belong in the middle of this, but because I don't want to make you into a freak show.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I bet you do. So once, this was at a time of a death, I felt as if I was having a nervous breakdown. And the feeling was the anxiety was so crippling, and I had that zero sense of control, felt like I was rattling inside. But the key thing was I felt like I might shatter, you know, explode into a million pieces and just not exist. That's how incapacitating that feeling was.
Well, yeah, the feeling of anxiety can be, you know, completely overwhelming. And you know, what you went through, all of us to some degree or another, or almost all of us, there's a point at which, you know, we are undergoing so much stress that you'll be overcome and you simply can't withstand it and start to break down. You know, some of us are more on the anxious side of the spectrum. Some have more resilience. But there's a point at which if subjected to enough external stress, your psychic defenses will start to break down and you'll start to feel completely out of control. And I appreciate your sharing that story. It's funny, I talked to a friend of mine who had written, when she read my book, she had previously written a book about being a cancer survivor in which she talks about all kinds of incredibly embarrassing personal things. And people would come up to her and start asking her all these questions. And she would say, before I can talk to you, I need to level the playing field. You need to tell me some incredibly personal story before I can even talk to you. So I appreciate you doing that.
Oh, that is so smart of her. You know, having said that, that this is going to sound like I was just trying to give myself permission to list some of your anxieties. But I want people to know that when it's extreme, this is what it can feel like. You know, rather than underlining sentences from your book, which I have read, and it is incredible, here's it from what was listed in the New York Times book review. Scott's anxieties include claustrophobia, acrophobia, aerophobia, and a mysterious fear of cheese. Also, panic attacks, a nervous stomach, stage fright. He has bolted in the middle of interviews and speaking gigs. That concerned me. He has soiled himself on airplanes. At the altar, preparing to take his wedding vows, he looked so fitful and intensely sweaty that the minister asked if he was okay. He was, and he wasn't, as he fought the shaking of his limbs, quote, the urge to vomit and unconsciousness. Okay, so I don't think I've even scratched the surface with some of that. There's a lot more. This is why I say you're one of the bravest people I know. It takes amazing courage. What is that thing inside you, besides medication and alcohol, that allows you to somehow find the tiniest little perch to not let go?
Well, it's funny. You're not the first who said that this, that my writing is fearless. And it's funny because I sometimes feel like, well, actually, it's the opposite. Isn't it quite fearful? It's all about my fears. But I wrestled a lot with, despite suffering from this kind of panoply of anxieties that, extend the range of what you just listed and beyond. I have, I was first diagnosed with anxiety disorder when I was 10, and I'm 44 years old now. So I have managed, to conceal it very effectively from colleagues and friends for 34 years. So I had this kind of great trepidation about, coming out with this all in a book, where I, in effect, come out as anxious and reveal all of my anxious symptoms and sometimes, embarrassing predicaments that my anxiety causes to the world. And basically what I wanted to do with my age of anxiety was, I didn't set out actually to write a memoir. What I really wanted to do was do an exploration of anxiety. But since I'm not myself a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a historian of science, what I realize is that, where I have the most authority is kind of on my own anxiety. So I end up kind of using myself as a case study and sort of go on this quest to try to understand the roots of my own anxiety as a means of trying to figure out what is the function of anxiety in, the human condition, what's it been like, how have people thought of it in different historical periods, how do, philosophers versus scientists versus psychologists think of it. So I, in the book, I end up sort of presenting myself as my own case study, and it's incredibly subjective in some ways, where I'm, putting you, the reader, through what I went through, but I also try to get sort of a radical distance on it and look at myself almost as a clinical case with some detachment. And so I hope my hope was to try to convey, both the experience of anxiety, but also a lot of information and kind of the historical and scientific context that surrounds it.
People mistakenly think that this is about some kind of mind control. If you can just kind of get yourself together, if you change your attitude, if you say the right things, if you start exercising, I mean, there's a list. I've heard this from people endlessly, often people who don't believe in the value of medication. And I'm just shaking my head in amazement. I think, oh, you don't know what it's like when something like this descends on you. You think that's right?
Yeah, no, I do think that's right. I mean, it is true that there are, I'm a big proponent of exercise, like my own experience, and there's a vast literature that these sort of banal things, banal sounding things like getting enough sleep and getting enough exercise actually are hugely important in keeping your overall sense of well-being and your levels of depression and anxiety down. But what you say is exactly true, that someone's in the throes of severe anxiety or having an anxiety attack, if someone just says, get a hold of yourself, you can't. That's the whole point. It's almost like your mind and your body have been hijacked by this kind of physiological set of cascading reactions that you can't get out of. And it's what a panic attack is, or severe anxiety is, in some ways, is an adaptive human response. It's the fight or flight response, but gone awry, and firing, at the wrong time. I mean, if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger or being mugged, it makes sense for you to be having this, cascade of physiological reactions where your mouth goes dry and suddenly your perception becomes more acute and you start sweating and your stomach hurts and all the blood flows away from your digestive system to your limbs. And in that situation, it's adaptive. When it's happening when you're sitting on an airplane or in a classroom or on a date, and you're having all of these horrible physical sensations and you feel like you're going to pass out or throw up or that you're having a heart attack and going to die, and meanwhile your thoughts are running away from you, you can't get a hold of yourself, and that's the problem.
I love this quote from Barry Wolf, his book Understanding and Treating Anxiety Disorders in 2005. He says, and you quote him, "No one who has ever been tormented by prolonged bouts of anxiety doubts its power to paralyze action, promote flight, eviscerate pleasure, and skew thinking toward the catastrophic. None would deny how terribly painful the experience of anxiety can be. The experience of chronic or intense anxiety is, above all else, a profound and perplexing confrontation with pain." It made me think about how movies portray this anxiety. You know, you see the typical sweating behavior, but then so often the directors have the character run. You know, you see the sweating, you see the panic in the eyes, the face, and then the person just starts running as hard as he or she can. In no particular direction, just to kind of get away, not just from the thing chasing you, but from the self.
Well, that's the problem, is that, you know, when you're at your worst, if you're, and that's sort of the difference between fear and anxiety. You know, fear is, if you're afraid, and this is a distinction that Freud made between, you know, fear and anxiety, or between neurotic anxiety and what he called real anxiety. If you're afraid of something concrete, like a poisonous snake or a bad guy, you know, you can run away from it. Anxiety is often irrational, and it's often within yourself. And so, you know, that's the worst part of it all. You can't get away from it because it's inside you. And I've experienced this sort of overwhelming terror where you feel like, I've got to run, I've got to get away from this. But wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah.
As fast as you can run, you're still there. And so, you know, you're better off using techniques like, you know, mindfulness meditation or deep breathing, or just trying to let the anxiety sort of wash over you and then pass.
Ah, so you mentioned mindfulness. When I think back to that, the time of the death and the, my response, there was no way that someone could have said, I practice mindfulness. There was no way that someone could have tried that with me at that moment and said, now breathe and feel where your body is at this moment. You know, all the things that we do, it was impossible. You know, there was just nothing to be said that was going to calm me down, short of a couple of pills.
Right. Well, that's the terrible irony, that things like mindfulness, meditation, or yoga, you know, the people for whom it's most important and necessary are those people who will have the most trouble actually managing to do it. I mean, they've done these studies on, you know, really highly trained Buddhist monks who are expert at meditating, and they are really good at it, but they'll never find themselves, you know, precisely because they've managed to achieve such kind of mastery over their own mind, they'll never find themselves in a situation where they're completely feeling anxious and out of control, whereas, you know, some of the rest of us, that's exactly right. You know, you can't just calm down. You can't find, you know, you have such persistent sense of agitation. And again, as you know, I talk about in the book, for me, it sounds like for you too, you know, sometimes medication is the only thing that can kind of overcome the you know, powerful workings of your own, the firing of your own neurons. And, you know, the really horrifying thing, I mean, I've been blessed that, for me, you know, medication is a complicated thing, and I have, you know, even though I've relied heavily on it on and off for 30 years, it's been very helpful to me, but despite some misgivings. But there are people for whom medication doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
and that's a terrifying thought, you know, that for me, it's the last resort is always I can take, you know, a pill or another pill, and eventually I can achieve a sense of sort of sedation or stupefaction that relieves the anxiety. But, you know, if you become too dependent on the medications, they won't work as effectively anymore, and you need a higher and higher dosage. They come with risks of dependency and things like that. So, you know, it's a complicated business, and there are people for whom they don't work at all from the start.
And
the people who often end up in a hospital.
Yeah, and if you have anxiety, the irony here is that the one thing your anxieties tell you is that the medication might not be safe. And so you're in this circle, this loop that is so tricky to deal with. Scott Stossel, please stay where you are. He's author of My Age of Anxiety, a memoir and a biography of anxiety. It took him 8 years to research this through all disciplines, and it is amazing. We're going to take a short break and then come back, and we'll get your calls later in the show. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Scott Stossel is my guest, editor of The Atlantic, author of this book, My Age of Anxiety. He suffers from severe anxiety attacks, and yet he's been brave enough in the midst of them to write this honest memoir about himself and what has plagued us all at one time or another, anxiety. And as we go back to this conversation, I invite you to watch for Connecticut Public Television, CPTV, An Honest Look at Mental Illness. This is a recording of the Connecticut Forum's March program. The CPTV show provides professional insight and personal stories highlighting the difficulties of coping with mental illness. WNPR's John Dankosky moderates the discussion, and panelists include Andrew Solomon, mental health advocate, Dr. Hank Schwartz, chief of psychiatry at the Institute of Living, and Dr. Kay Redfield Jameson, author of An Unquiet Mind, an unbelievable book. Each of the panelists presents the realities of living with a mental illness and suggestions for understanding these complicated conditions. That's what we're talking about here on the show. And the discussion topics on the TV show include social perceptions, workplace stigmas, and perpetuating stereotypes. The premiere of An Honest Look at Mental Health on CPTV is April 8th and will be repeated during that month. So check your local listings, and you can go online for more information to cptv.org. Okay, Scott Stossel, here is a fascinating fact for me from your book, that almost every age considers itself the most anxious age. And I mean in terms of eras. I had been thinking, well, I bet they felt this back in the Industrial Revolution, but you've gone way further back than that.
Yeah, no, that was one of the things that was most striking to me about my research. I went into it thinking that, because everyone talks about how anxious they are today, and it's sort of almost an article of faith that we live in the age of anxiety. But when you start to look back through previous eras, you know, every age sort of presumes to think itself the most anxious ever. So if you look back at the dawn of the atomic age, right after World War II, or during World War I, or during the Gilded Age, or during, as you say, the Industrial Revolution, or during the Renaissance, or even during the late Roman Empire, you know, you read both physicians of the time and social commentators talking about how they've never seen so many anxious people and how the whole society is kind of riven by anxiety. But I do think that what all of those eras have in common, and what have in common with our own, is that there really are certain social features of different societies that provoke greater levels of anxiety. And they're all present in the current age. And those include things like, you know, uncertainty. Obviously, we have great economic uncertainty now, but there's also, all eras of great social change where people's social roles are dramatically being called into question. And ironically, the last, several hundred years have provided great advances in political and economic liberty, at least in the West. And those are, on balance, net very good things. But the problem is they also come with choice actually creates anxiety. And so, I realize a lot of sociologists look back at the Middle Ages, and if we had been born then, our lives would have been materially a lot worse than today. We probably would have died at an earlier age. We would have been subject to all kinds of horrible diseases, and you have no choice in life. Life sounds actually rather miserable. But we probably would have been free of the kind of neurotic anxieties that plague us today, because you would have been born into the role that you would inhabit. There was no question of what do you want to do when you grow up. You were what you were born into. There was no question about who will I marry, or what college should I go to, or which of 57 kinds of breakfast cereal do I buy when I go into the grocery store, which is sort of a trivial example, but one that actually researchers show does cause anxiety. So there's a sense in which anxiety is a luxury of the developed world, where we have the freedom to make choices, and but at the same time all this underlying uncertainty about the economy and about all the things we see in the media, terrorism and disappearing planes and things like that, that we wouldn't have been aware of 500 years ago.
Yeah, this gets us to the nature versus nurture thing, where, of course, how can environment, how you grew up, what people said around you, what events you witnessed, not have an effect on your overall constitution? And then there's the genes that get passed on from others who might have been anxious, or just a fluke of wiring. So don't you think, because you've taken a genetic, they have genetic tests for this now. When I read your story, I thought, oh, this is wiring. You know, I mean, not that really tough things haven't happened to you and lots of other people to add to the stew, but I thought that something this extreme has to be a kind of misfiring. What do you think?
Yes, I think that's basically right. I mean, but it's impossible to completely untangle the relationship between nature and nurture. And I do think that at base, anxiety as a condition, and particularly as a clinical condition, is a biologically hardwired thing that is to a large degree programmed by your genes. And some people have constellation of genes that make them, you know, more prone to anxiety, and some people make them less prone. But that fundamentally, you know, this is a part of the human condition, and we all have it. But genes aren't destiny, and I did get myself tested, and in my book I talk a lot about the discussions I had with my therapist about, you know, when I found out the results of my test that I sort of tested in effect positive for a couple of anxious genes, and I also talk about the experience of one of my ancestors, or he was a living ancestor when I was born. My great grandfather was a very successful man. He was dean of Harvard College, and when he got to middle age, when he was in his 50s. He had a kind of, you know, complete nervous breakdown, and then a series of nervous breakdowns. He ended up hospitalized for long stretches of time. And so my fear is, you know, clearly I have these anxious genes. Is this my fate? And my psychologist would always say is, look, genes are not destiny. And that's absolutely true, because overlaid on top of your genes are the upbringing that you had. You know, were you subjected to trauma? What are your life and social circumstances, and a certain degree of luck? And furthermore, and you know, this is the sort of positive thing that everyone can kind of take away from this, is that, you know, nowadays psychologists and psychiatrists look at resilience as a trait they talk about as something that, you know, is that your degree of resilience helps predict how resistant you are to anxiety and depression, or how well you'll be able to recover from them if you do develop them. And resilience is also genetic, and yet it can also be learned. You can cultivate it in various ways. And so one of the messages that I try to take away from my own research is that, you know, teach yourself to be more resilient, train yourself to be more resilient.
Because, as you point out, resilience, we're hardwired for that too, and you can build that muscle.
Yeah, it is like a muscle. I mean, you know, practice, and this is, you know, a lot of psychotherapies today for people with anxiety involved what's known as exposure therapy, and that's, in effect, exposing yourself to the thing that you fear, whether that's heights or subways or airplanes, and teaching yourself that you can handle the anxiety, and you know, you go on longer and longer flights, or go up in higher and higher buildings if you're afraid of heights, and again, you sort of building a kind of resilience, and demonstrating that you have, you know, some self-efficacy.
This is when I hear, we're not sitting face to face, so I've got the tone of your voice, and I'm a careful listener, so I hear a kind of sureness in you, and I think to myself, I would imagine that you know, through doing these interviews, the book is out now, you're getting reactions, even all your family members didn't want this book to come out, but yet you're doing it. You know, you're getting through these interviews. You're saying really smart things. The book's amazing. Are you better? Do you feel more liberated? Do you feel? Can you see it?
It's funny, people ask that, and I mean, the short answer is the jury's still out. But I actually think that yes, a little bit. And I mean, the irony is, you know, I originally got the idea to do this book when I was about to publish my first book. 10 yeah. years ago, and I was sort of, you know, I'd obviously dealt with anxiety for many years, but I was paralyzed with anxiety about the impending book tour. So I already was seeing a psychiatrist, but I sought out help from a bunch of other different specialists, and that's kind of when I got the idea of, you know, maybe there's kind of a rich enough material here that I could write a book about it. So I spent the next, you know, 8 years researching and writing it. Now here I am rewarded with another book tour. But the good thing about it is that it has been a kind of exposure therapy. And, you know, the first ones, it's now been out for 2.5 months. And the first interviews that I did actually, you know, before the book even came out were, you know, rather terrifying for me, and required, you know, copious amounts of medication to get through. As I've done more and more of them, you know, partly I just think through practice and it, like I say, exposure therapy. I do think that the anxiety level has come down a little bit, and I've, you know, progressively medicated less and less for them. And so they're that, to that, in that respect, it has been kind of liberating. And on top of that too, just the fact that I, you know, published the book and I had, as I said earlier, you know, sort of deep ambivalence about, do I really want to, you know, in effect, like, reveal to the world my kind of anxiety and vulnerability. I'm not going to be able to put the genie back in the bottle after that. And the book came out and the world didn't end, and people don't seem to treat me that much differently, or if they do, it's almost with a kind of deeper respect, which was not what I was expecting, because I have this shame around the anxiety. So I think that the act of publishing the book has you know, been useful in trying to reduce the shame and stigma associated with my own anxiety, and become a kind of a tool to help others do the same. I've been, you know, incredibly heartened by the number of responses I've gotten from either anxious, clinically anxious people or family members of them, uh-huh. all of whom have said, you know, for the anxious people, they say it helped them feel less alone and somehow, you know, almost inspired. And for the people who may not themselves be anxious but have anxious family members, it says this helps them to understand their relatives or husbands or wives or
Yeah.
daughters, what have you.
Oh, and Scott, I think about the shame word. We have heard this for so long from people who are prescribed antidepressants by their doctors, and how they keep this a secret from so many people, including their own family members. They're so ashamed about what that means to be called depressed or to have to take these drugs. And I can't imagine this isn't helpful to them too.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, you know, going back to when I was, you know, I started seeing a psychiatrist when I was 10 years old, and I would, you know, my parents sort of absorbed the social norms about this, that this was a shameful thing, and that, you know, don't let anyone know that you see a psychiatrist because people will think you're crazy and you'll never be able to get a job. So when I went off to college and I was continuing to see a psychiatrist, I would have to, you know, concoct all of these excuses for, you know, where I was going. When in fact I was going to see my therapist, and you know the notion that you know 20 years later I hear I would be on a public radio show or you know on a national television show as I've done to talking about my medications would have been sort of absolutely unthinkable. And you know I still wrestle with this a little bit, but that aspect of this has been liberating, and I think it has kind of unleashed the number of people who have come up and shared stories with me. People that I know who I never would have expected had anxiety, which you know, some people say about me, and people that I don't know, and even some celebrities, you know, have come uh-huh. forward and say, you know, thank you for publishing this. This has really helped me to understand myself. So that's been very validating, and I think does help me feel better about my own anxiety.
So let me open the phones, 203-776-9677, if you want to talk about anxiety. Scott Stossel is on the line with me. He's editor of The Atlantic and author of this new book, My Age of Anxiety. He suffers from severe anxiety, as you can hear, these attacks, and yet he has been very brave and spent 8 years writing this honest memoir about himself, all these anxieties, kind of weird things that he can convince himself of, and what I guess has plagued all of us at one time or another to a different degree, anxiety. And I'm going to let you know shortly about a Connecticut Public Television special that is coming up in April having to do with mental illness. David Faith Middleton with Scott Stossel. Welcome to the show, David.
Okay, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, the thing I wanted to say, and I haven't been listening that long, so I'm not sure whether you already emphasized this. I'm expecting you did. But, you know, I've had a history of major depressive disorder and social anxiety disorder and various other problems for the past 10 years now, and a lot of people think that people with depression and anxiety and some things are somehow weak. And maybe in some cases, uh-huh. I would like to make the point that confronting your problems and going through your day-to-day life and functioning at a bare minimum, and maybe over time functioning at a more normal level, takes a lot of strength and courage and endurance. And I think people don't really understand that they don't understand the challenges that people who are mentally ill go through and just how much effort it takes for those with more severe disorders to just go about their day-to-day life.
Yes? Yeah, David. David, this is such a great point, and I'm so appreciative that you called and said this. For me, you're getting at two things. That for everybody, it takes courage to just get up in the morning and put one foot in front of the other. But for some who face a challenge like the one you're talking about, David, and Scott, too, that putting one foot in front of the other is pretty tough. And the biggest challenge is that the mind you need to help yourself is the part that's kind of screwed up. And so it makes it even harder. And so I have the utmost respect for you. That you're moving forward. So thanks, David.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Glad you called.
Okay, and I would add to that. I mean, it's the David's exactly right that there's this social perception that anxiety equals weakness. And you know, this is something that I'd internalized. I found this amazing quote that they'd posted on during World War II on Allied gun sites in Malta, and it said, "If you are a man, your self-respect will not permit you to show anxiety, neurosis, or fear." Now, again, you know, obviously, if you're in the military, you have good reason in wanting to prevent fear and anxiety in your soldiers. And yet, you know, this seems to me to be the prevailing view of anxiety that, you know, particularly in men, anxiety equals weakness. And to David's point, too, you know, that there are often strengths tied to the mental illnesses. You know, this is not to say that most of us wouldn't trade them in if we couldn't get rid of them. And yet, you know, there's a lot of evidence that people with various forms of, you know, anxiety, depression, and other disorders are able to tap into deeper kinds of creativity, say, or maybe have more active imaginations. I mean, I talked to one therapist who said many of his most miserable patients, most anxious patients, are lawyers. But he says if you're looking for a really good lawyer, you should hire an anxious lawyer because they're brilliant at imagining all kinds of worst case catastrophes for themselves and for their clients, and are then able to better prepare cases.
So interesting, Scott. Please stay with us because we want to continue. We want to talk to our callers at 203-776-9677, and we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. Wanted to let you know, in terms of watching, Connecticut Public Television, CPTV, is doing a program called An Honest Look at Mental Illness. And what the station did was we recorded the Connecticut Forum's March event. And so now CPTV is going to show a program about professional insight, personal stories highlighting the difficulties of coping with mental illness. WNPR's John Dankosky moderates the discussion, and the panelists are Andrew Solomon, mental health advocate, Dr. Hank Schwartz, chief of psychiatry at the Institute of Living, and Dr. Kay Redfield Jamison, who's author of An Unquiet Mind. And each of these panelists presents the realities of living with a mental illness, suggestions for understanding these complicated conditions, and the discussion topics include social perceptions, workplace stigmas, perpetuating stereotypes. You hear my guest Scott Stossel, who's author of The Age of Anxiety. He's editor of The Atlantic, talking about all of these things. So the premiere of An Honest Look at Mental Health on CPTV is An Honest Look at Mental Illness is April 8th on CPTV. It will be repeated during the month. You can check your local listings. Go online now to cptv.org. Scott Stossel is with me, as I mentioned, author of My Age of Anxiety. Todd, welcome to the show. Go ahead, Todd.
Hi. Good afternoon, Faith.
Hi.
being someone who has suffered from anxiety disorder for 40 some odd years, I will tell you, for me, the secret was to surround myself with supportive people who knew my anxiety disorders and could sort of coach me through it, or allowed me to sort of be quiet or process or be who I was without judgment. I mean, that was sort of key for me. I mean, there was a point in my life where I couldn't drive out of my hometown for just fear of being lost or whatever the anxiety was at the time. And now I'm flying to the West Coast by myself and, you know, things like that. So
wait, Todd, so how did that happen, that you made that kind of progress? What's the key thing?
Well, I have to say, it's taken 40 years. I mean, I started suffering from anxiety disorder, probably the same as Scott, from around 10 years old. I'm 50 now.
Yep.
And it's been a process, and it's been three steps forward, one step backwards. But I find that surrounding myself with people who get it, who are non-judgmental, who can, like I said, coach me through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time I ever got on a plane by myself was huge. You know, and I flew to Baltimore, not that far, but that was a sense of accomplishment. And it sort of snowballed from there. I will also tell you that there's a small paperback book that I would carry around with me. It was called Hope and Helps for Your Nerves by Dr. Claire Weeks.
Huh.
And that book I carried with me everywhere. And I would read it and say, it was just so affirming, saying, this is me.
Yeah, you know? So you had your own little pocket coach.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was huge book for me.
Todd so. And Scott, I'm addressing this to both of you because you same length of time with your anxiety. Sounds like some overlap here. Anxiety, as Dr. Nancy Horn, our on-air psychologist, has talked about on many occasions, anxiety is contagious. If you're around someone who's very, very anxious, you kind of can catch the vibe, the feeling of it, and suddenly now two of you are anxious. This can make conflict happen. This can get things all screwed up. Have either of you experienced this?
Go ahead, Scott.
Well, because first of all, that the book by Claire Weeks, I also highly recommend it. It's like 50, 60 years old. She wrote it, I think, in the 40s, 50s, or 60s. I can't remember now. And it's many people have, I read it while researching my book. And then since then, Todd's not the first to actually say that book, even though it's not, you know, it's not drawing on cutting edge neuroscience or like a lot of the most up-to-date research, there is something where, you know, she clearly understands the condition and, provides these sort of affirming, exhortations that are quite helpful for many people. Perversely for me, as far as, you know, the anxiety and contagion, I mean, that's definitely a real thing, and that's why militaries work so hard to try to stamp out anxiety for precisely that reason, because, you know, if you're in a war situation, the last thing you want is anxiety running rampant through the ranks. I sometimes have the opposite experience, where if other people are anxious, it kind of draws me out of myself, and I go from being the caretaken to the caretaker. It doesn't always work that way, but sometimes it's a helpful way to draw me out of myself.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, Todd, thank you so much for being on the show your great comments.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Have you had, it sounds like Todd has good friends, and he's careful about, he's curating his friends where he says, all right, these people are going to get it. They're going to work with me when they need to. Just like with death, people can get around anxiety because it feels contagious and pull away from you. Because, you know, someone's very sick, dying, you can pull away from that person. Have you experienced that, Scott, where people distance themselves from you a little bit?
I mean, happily, not really. And again, partly this was because I worked so hard to hide it. And I mean, Todd's right that, I mean, again, all the evidence suggests that for both people with anxiety and depression, but just in general, if you're dealing with stressful times, having a strong social support network is incredibly valuable. And that's why it can be so damaging to do what I did, which was to be, you know, to hide it, because you feel like you're doing what, again, one of my therapists calls impression management. And impression management is both a symptom of your anxiety, because there's certain types of it's a particular strain of people treated with panic disorder who are afraid of being revealed as anxious. So they go to enormous lengths to try to hide the anxiety, to you know, project this outward veneer of competence and confidence that hide the vulnerability within. So that on the one hand is a kind of a symptom of anxiety that causes you to do this impression management. But the terrible thing about impression management is that it's also a cause of it, because it's a lot of work. Because you're always afraid that, you know, you're going to putting all this work into maintaining this facade. And the fear is that, like, if somebody knows, if you have a panic attack on stage or if you're shown to be weak, suddenly the whole house of cards, which is this facade, will come crashing down.
Wow.
And what Todd has done that sounds like it's very smart is that, you know, the people who are around him understand him for who he is, and he's not trying to hide it, and they're able to therefore, you know, he can reach out to them and they can probably support him.
Wow.
And he's got his inside self and his outside self kind of authentically aligned, which is a very helpful thing in being mentally healthy.
Scott, you've made me understand somebody. I used to know a guy years ago who was, I think anybody who knew him would describe him as an adventurer. I mean, he was always doing these wild, amazing things and feats, and yet if I happened to be around him and an upsetting story came up on television, he would leap at the television to shut it off. You know, people dying in a storm, or you know, someone had been raped, and he'd run and shut the television off. And I could see that it was really made him anxious. And I thought, what? How do these two things go together? And now you're making me wonder if that was I watching impression management? Someone who felt compelled to be an adventurer, to you know, maybe hide that more vulnerable part of himself.
That could well be true, and it could also be just. It's one of the things that was fascinating about as I researched the book. You know, the myriad ways in which anxiety can present itself, and you know, for instance, I met a woman who she's a war correspondent. And, you know, she goes to all these dangerous places where she gets shot at, and she's a woman in places where, you know, women are, you know, a lot of times are, you know, not supposed to be seen outside of wearing a hijab.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's much more adventurous than I am. I mean, I'm afraid to get on a plane or travel any great distance, but she confessed to me that if she, you know, as a journalist has sent, you know, an article off to a publication is waiting to hear back, she'll be sort of overcome with anxiety and depression about, you know, how is she going to be judged? And, you know, she actually ends up becoming an alcoholic and you know, developing all these other kind of anxious symptoms. And I mean, this is what Freud said, is that sometimes, you know, threats from within the self to your, you know, idea of yourself or your self-esteem are greater than, you know, actual physical threats. But again, it just sort of shows that, you know, there are so many different ways that the human mind can kind of invent anxieties to torment ourselves with. And, you know, everyone has it in their own ways. You've got people who are completely adventurous physically, but are socially anxious, or people who are socially confident, but, you know, lack physical confidence. So,
and who's to say that this man I knew years ago didn't have just some weird little thing about the television stories? You know, you have a thing about cheese. You know, maybe his thing was the television. I don't know. So this is Scott Stossel. He is editor of The Atlantic and author of My Age of Anxiety. He spent 8 years, and it turns out to be a memoir biography, a memoir because he's telling his own story about crippling anxieties he has faced for 40 years and managed to do so many things. And also a kind of biography of anxiety and what we know about it. And in the end, we know some things, but we certainly don't know everything. As many as 40 million people say that they have battled anxiety every year, we're talking about. Marianne, Faith Middleton with Scott Stossel. Go ahead, Marianne.
First of all, I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so nice of you. Go ahead.
I'd be very interested to know what Scott found as being helpful, or what he might suggest that would be helpful to deal with children that have anxiety, like as a grandparent, a parent, an aunt, or just a support friend. How can you help a child that's showing symptoms of anxiety? What's the best thing to do?
Well, a good question. And, I mean, first of all, I would say it's very important if a child seems to be, you know, in great distress or really suffering from what seems like it could be clinical anxiety, it's crucially important to get them help early. There's lots of evidence. There was a big research study at Harvard that showed that, you know, if you allow anxiety disorders to go untreated in children,
You know, they can develop into more severe disorders, depression and addiction and things like that as they get into young adulthood and then adulthood. One great resource, just in general, whether you have a child, who is suffering from anxiety or if you are yourself or if you know someone who is there's a nonprofit group called the ADAA, which is the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. And their website is ADAA.org. They're not selling anything. They're just a consortium of researchers who specialize in anxiety, and it's a resource for patients and family members. And you can go to this website, and it will tell you information just about the anxiety disorders, but will also help you find therapists in your area if you feel like you need one. For kids today, you know, the one of the most effective forms of treatment these days is known as CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy. And I talk in my book about, I mean, this mm-hmm. was, we were talking about genetics earlier, and it was horrifying to me to watch my kids start to develop some of the same phobias and anxieties that I had at exactly the same ages, even though I'd gone to great lengths to try to, you know, prevent this. And we put them both into therapy. And, you know, for my daughter, who's now 10, you know, the joke is that she's much better than I am. my son is still a work in progress, but therapy can be very, very effective.
So, yeah. Thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. I can understand, Scott, how starting early, the way you respond to your environment, it cuts patterns of behavior in the brain. Those grooves get, carved in there, and that just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So I can see how early intervention makes a difference. So as you point out in your book, much of the research is inconclusive about anxiety. We know some things more clearly than we've ever known. And yet, so what's the frontier? What are we looking to?
Well, anxiety field is hugely rich and yielding all kinds of fascinating insights. I mean, most of the cutting edge research is in a few different areas, but you kind of see a convergence here between Eastern and Western medicine. Because on the one hand, there's tons of interesting findings. I mean, you know, thousands of studies a year on the neuroscience of anxiety and other forms of mental illness and just general brain mechanisms. That is to say, you know, what are the actual, you know, sections of the brain or the mm-hmm. neurotransmitter systems that are producing anxiety or resistance to anxiety? Another area is molecular genetics, which is, again, you know, what are the constellation of genes that lead to an anxious temperament? And that, you know, learning about this may actually help doctors predict which patients will respond to which medications.
Yeah.
And all of this is sort of leading to advances in psychopharmacology. But then there's also all this evidence about mindfulness meditation and hypnosis and things that are, you know, come more from the East. They're now starting to apply, you know, Western empirical style, you know, double-blind controlled tests to it and find that there's a real, you know, biological medical basis to it. So,
yeah, the neurobiologist John Kabat-Zinn has learned that. Hey, thank you,
yeah.
Scott. I can't thank you enough. I wish you the best, and to your family too. I really love this book. It is such an amazing contribution to life. Thank you so much.
Well, very kind of you to say, and thank you for having me on.
Scott Stossel, he's editor of The Atlantic and author of My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Wanted to let you know that Connecticut Public Television will air An Honest Look at Mental Illness, a recording of the Connecticut Forum's March program. The CPTV show will provide professional insight, personal stories highlighting the difficulties of coping with mental illness. WNPR's John Dan Koski moderates. The panelists are terrific, including Dr. Kay Redfield Jamison, author of An Unquiet Mind. And they're going to get into how complicated this is, and the discussion topics include social perceptions, workplace stigmas, and perpetuating stereotypes. The premiere of An Honest Look at Mental Illness on CPTV is April 8th, and it will be repeated during the month, so check your local listings. Go online to cptv.org. Thank you so much for listening. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, recipes, wine, cocktails, everything right now at WNPR.org. Click on programs.